Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're going to open up this morning with our friends from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. MAD is the nation's largest nonprofit working to protect families from drunk driving, drugged driving, and underage drinking. And anyone who knows about MAD's Connecticut chapter knows the great work they do right here at home. So we're going to talk to a couple of victims whose lives and families were shattered by drunk drivers and invite everyone out to support the cause at next Saturday's Walk Like MAD in Fairfield. Then we'll return to Adam's house in Shelton to bookend a previous segment we did before this unique facility opened. Adam's House provides comprehensive grief education programs to families looking for empathy, guidance, and support in a special place after the loss of a loved one through tragedy, illness, or accident. Then we'll wrap inviting you to one of the 9 performances of The Good Adoptee, a powerful live show that chronicles one adopted child's challenge to access her birth records and raising awareness for Access Connecticut, a grassroots organization dedicated to restoring the right of every adult in the state adoptees to access their original birth certificates, as well as CALO programs specializing in addressing the dysfunctional patterns that arise due to early trauma, particularly families with adopted children. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this news. Congregation Adath Israel of Newtown is excited to be presenting Simply Diamond, an evening of Neil Diamond music with an extraordinary cover band. The event is happening at Massac High School in Monroe on October 29th at 7 p.m. to help enable the congregation's future, providing Jewish faith, community support, outreach, and learning in the greater Newtown area. The event will also include a silent auction. For details, just go to ticketleap.com and access tickets for Simply Diamond or call 203-459-0089. Well, at least once a year we try to check in with local representatives of a nationwide organization that does such important and critical work. I'm talking about MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Founded by a mother whose daughter was killed by a drunk driver, MAD is the nation's largest nonprofit group working to protect families from drunk driving, drugged driving, and underage drinking. MAD also supports drunk and drugged driving victims and survivors at no charge through local MAD victims advocates and their 24-hour victim helpline, which is 877-MADD-HELP. If you know someone who's been affected by a drunk or drugged driver, or who may have a youth in their family who you know is involved in underage drinking, you might want to give the victim helpline a call or give that number to someone that you know, 877-MAD-HELP. We're pleased to be in studio today with some visitors, an old friend, a new friend, and a couple of old friends, actually. We are bringing in Jamie Roy, who's the walk manager for the last of the Walk Like MAD fundraising walks, which is coming up next weekend on October 22nd in Fairfield, 8:30 a.m. registration at the Fairfield Theater Company down on Sanford Street, and we'll hear more about that from Jamie. Jamie, thanks for coming in. Tell us a little bit about your transition to going to work for Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Thanks so much for having us, John. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is an amazing organization to work for. Mothers Against Drunk Driving has been in Connecticut for just over 30 years. Our executive director founded the Connecticut office herself and is still with the organization. Mm-hmm. We are first and foremost a victim and survivor organization. Throughout the country, MAD has served over 160,000 families just in 2015 alone. And that really is why we do what we do. We want to be there for families that have experienced tragedies, that are learning to live life again, either with injuries and impacts of drunk driving crashes, mm-hmm. or learning to live again with a loved one missing. So that is first and foremost why I love working for this organization, is just what we do in that aspect. But of course, there are other components, as you mentioned. Underage drinking is something that we are continuously, going out there, educating youth, educating parents how to talk with their kids about drinking and driving, as well as drug driving. We also partner with local law enforcement. Again, that whole community aspect of coming together and trying to save lives and making sure that people are making smart decisions and not getting behind the wheel after being involved in risky behavior.
Yeah, I think it's much to the credit of the Connecticut MAD chapter founder, who, as you mentioned, is 30 years plus strong with the organization. When you have both that personal experience that she had and the longevity, you make the relationships that, you know, as police chiefs and leadership in law enforcement organizations change, as state representatives and senators move in and out of office, there's that continuity really makes Connecticut's chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving an incredibly important and strong advocate for the cause. And she is everywhere. I mean, and she has affected such incredible work in Hartford with the in-car breathalyzer and starter locks and other initiatives. And it's great to hear now that you guys have sort of broadened your focus to further prevention by tackling this escalating kind of epidemic of youth drinking. So impaired driving. So it's great. Once again, if you know somebody who may need the help of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, they have a toll-free national number that will refer you back to your local victims advocates. It's 877-MADD-HELP, MADD, of course, for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And if you're hearing something or if something resonates from the other speakers that we're going to introduce in just a moment, we hope that you'll get involved by coming down to Fairfield, wherever you are in Connecticut, on October 22nd. For the final Walk Like Mad here in Connecticut for the season. If you'd like to learn more or register online, they have their own website. It's Walk Like Mad with two D's, walklikemad.org/Fairfield. And you can go on that website, I assume, and sign up and get pre-registered. Also, day of the event, you can walk up and get involved, right, Jamie?
Yep. So you can register up until the 21st. Usually about noon is when that cutoff happens for pre-registration. And then on October 22nd, starting at 8:30 until 9:30, people can come out and register that day to join us for the walk.
Okay. Well, as we have you shift the microphone over to Alice, who we'll talk to in a couple minutes, we will meet another person. Talk about longevity when it comes to advocacy. There's no voices that are stronger than the victims. And the victims are not only the individuals who lose their lives or have their lives horribly changed or derailed by drunk or drugged or impaired drivers, but of course those who are left behind after the tragic loss. Jim Rotuno is one of those people. We met him before on our program, and Jim, we thank you for coming back.
Thanks.
31, almost 32 years supporting Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Sadly, as we learned at your last visit, it was your brother who was lost to a drunk driver these many years ago, when the whole attitude about drinking and driving, and the way law enforcement sort of pursued and prosecuted and handled drunk drivers, it was a completely different world, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The laws that are in effect today were not there years ago. The particular person that was involved in this crash was pretty much got a little slap on the wrist, received some probation, and lost his license, and that was about all. So my involvement in MAD and my family's involvement in MAD, we've seen a tremendous change in the laws. One of the reasons why we stay involved, we want to be the voice of the people that were killed in this very preventable disease, I'll call it. Yeah. These crashes are, there's no need for it. It's again, I'll use the word preventable. With the help of MAD, with the help of people like Jamie and Janet and Michelle, Alice, who's a member of the National Committee as well, we stay on top of this and we keep these laws going and, and we do what we can. We talk to the people that we can. We try to be the voice again of our loved ones that were lost.
Yeah, you mentioned how things have changed so incredibly, and Matt played such an important role in that. I mean, I can't remember a holiday season now going back probably as long as you go back where we didn't hear that MAD was organizing tow truck drivers and cab companies to provide rides to individuals who, you know, go to holiday parties. Maybe that's the one or two times of the year that they go out and they have a little bit too much, so they get a safe ride home or their car gets brought home for them at low or no cost. But now today we have proliferation of ride services and other resources for people who can easily now just like click a button on their phone or have someone do it for them, no matter what condition they're in, and potentially be able to get a safe ride home and avoid being behind the wheel. But the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was, I don't know if you know today where the individual is that took your brother's life, but it has to be the worst feeling in the world, going back, as we said, in sort of the archaic days of law enforcement, where drunk drivers, even multiple offenders, got a slap on the wrist. They didn't do jail time. Maybe they didn't even lose their license. But the idea that the individual, was walking around out there, you might bump into them in the grocery store or see them in passing. It's got to be a nightmare.
The first court appearance, when we first went to court, the individual was standing about 50 feet away from us. We didn't know. We had no idea who he was. We didn't know who he was until we got in the courtroom. So to jump on what you said, it's very hard now to see that person standing in front of you, to listen to lawyers talk about how good he was and how, you know, what his involvement was in the community and all of this stuff, when you know that this person took your loved one's life. Very difficult.
Yeah.
To this day, very difficult.
Well, sorry for your loss, as we continue to express. And for all the folks that might be listening who know of a loved one, a coworker, a neighbor, perhaps like in the case of our other guest, Alice Carter, who lost her own child to a drunk driver. Just tragic. And as Jim so brilliantly pointed out, today especially, completely preventable, but also we're in a time where there is little or zero tolerance for impaired driving. So even the penalties that an individual will face on a first occasion of being caught drinking or impaired driving is severe. As I spoke with Alice briefly before we went on the air, we learned tragically that her son was killed while the family was on vacation in Florida. Alice, why don't you pick up from there and to the best of your ability, give us a recap on what happened in your case.
Well, thanks so much for having us here and helping us to get our message out. My son was killed by a drunk driver in 1995 when we were on vacation in Florida. He was 13 years old, and we were all crossing the street to go watch the sea turtles come up on the beach and lay their eggs. And, you know, this woman came out of nowhere, you know, and there were seven of us, and you know, we, of course, look both ways before you cross the street, and she just appeared and hit him while he was crossing the street, and his body flew like 80 feet. And, you know, unfortunately, they tell us that he died instantly, so at least he wasn't in any pain. But, you know, to run and see your child at 13 years old laying in the street, knocked right out of his shoes, it's pretty devastating. And my daughter, who was only 10 years old at the time, was right there. And, you know, that is still with her today. It's still with all of us today. And it's just devastating to know that people choose to do this. The woman was 53 years old. Her blood alcohol was 1.5 times the legal limit. And, you know, here we were in Florida. You know, we weren't with family, and we had to deal with this and the police station and, you know, the woman's family. And, you know, we came home right away, but had to go back, you know. And ironically, we went back for the court hearing almost a year to the day of him being killed. And like Jim said earlier, you know, she got a slap on the wrist because at that time there was not a victim advocate for MAD in that area. And I was dealing with the homicide victim advocate. Mm-hmm. And it is homicide. You know, he was an innocent kid crossing the street. And, you know, unfortunately, she just got jail time, or she didn't get any jail time. I'm sorry. She got a slap on the wrist, community service and house arrest. And her lawyer was, you know, oh, you know, she's very upset by this. She's got to live with it for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
But we have to live without Danny for the rest of our lives. Yeah. And it's tough, you know, when you see his friends getting married and having children. Last year, the Fairfield Walk was in his memory, and we had over 100 people on our team. Because they all came out for Danny, which is just a wonderful tribute to him.
Mm.
But, you know, I've been involved with MAD for the last 21 years. And, you know, like Jim said, we do whatever we can to get the message out, go to any of the events that are there. And, you know, I'm on the not the national board, but the state advisory board,
yeah,
because
yeah.
I want to keep on top of things and make sure that Danny's life was not lost in vain.
Yeah, well, you can't tell a story like that and not have it like cut to the soul of everybody. Mm-hmm. And you know, certainly a horrible situation, but also you know, kudos to you for speaking and reinforcing the ripple effect that this has, and you know, especially with the younger sister who survived. You know, there's no better statement or evidence as to how a drunk driving incident continues to haunt and punish the victims, you know, forever after it happens. Mm-hmm. So all the more reason to come out and support this final Walk Like MAD here in Connecticut. It's happening next Saturday, October 22nd in Fairfield. It starts at the Fairfield Theater Company right by the train station. If you're coming down Interstate 95, just get off at the Fairfield train station exit and you will find the big crowd gathering for the Walk Like MAD in Fairfield County. That is going to start their registration at 8:30 a.m. So in the last minute or so that we have, we go back to Jamie Roy, our good and long friend here at the award-winning For the People, to give a final shout-out. And we will see you, Jamie, and Jim, and Alice, and the many, many other victims and supporters who can come out on October 22nd.
Yeah, and I just have to say, it's still, no matter how many times I hear Jim and Alice's story, it just is humbling and, of course, inspiring to just hear how they've turned such tragedies into such inspiring actions. And again, that is why MAD exists, and that is why we go out and walk. We in Connecticut, you can, of course, contact our office at any time to speak with a victim advocate. But these walks are very important because it is our signature fundraising event. It is how we fund being able to do this work in our community. So I really urge you, if you can come out and walk with us on the 22nd, again, registration at 8:30 a.m. Even if you're not able to come, you can go on to walklikemad.org/Fairfield to make a donation. Fundraising will be open through November 22nd. So I just urge you to register and or donate if you can.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving is the nation's largest nonprofit working to protect families from drunk driving, drug driving, and now underage drinking as well. Connecticut's chapter particularly works hard on many fronts, including up in the State House in Hartford with important legislation that is making a fundamental difference and kind of putting laws between individuals who are chronic drunk drivers and their vehicles to help make a difference. If you'd like to learn more, or if you know somebody who needs the help of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, it's 877-MADD-HELP. That's their 24-hour victim helpline. You can go to mad.org to learn more or find out or get linked through to the Connecticut chapter. And if you'd like to come out or pre-register for the walk, it's walklikemad.org/Fairfield. I want to thank our guests once again, Jamie Roy, Alice Carter, and Jim Rotuno for being back with us once again to tell their stories. Yes. Oh, we're back in Shelton, and we're pleased to be able to kind of bookend a program that we did almost a year ago now with Allison Wysota and Adam's House
here, supported by the Adam Wysota Foundation. Adam's House supports children and families coping with the death of a loved one. Connecticut is so rich in support systems with the soon-to-be-opened brand-new Ronald McDonald House that kind of provides a real wrapping support service for families whose children are receiving intensive medical services. We've got the Fisher House about to break ground in West Haven at the VA that will supply families of our military heroes an opportunity to be close to their loved ones while they're undergoing procedures and support at the VA. We've got numerous facilities that support everybody from individuals coming out of incarceration to those with disabilities and other financial challenges. Here in Shelton, Adam's House is quite unique in that it is providing a wrapping service to individuals and families who are looking for a healing place to recover from the death of a loved one. So we go first to our host today, Allison Wysota, to give us, beyond that minimal description, a little bit of background and history on how this all came together. Allison, thanks for having us back.
Oh, well, thanks for coming. Basically, Adam's House started after the loss of my husband, who passed away unexpectedly of a heart attack. I have three children. At the time, they were 17, 13, and 11. In my search for services for them, it was very isolated, and it was therapy. And while that was helpful, they were really craving the need to be with other children going through the same loss that they were. So out of that kind of came the idea that we really need to provide an area that's not medically oriented, that just really provides the peer support and also kind of teaches these children what it means to go through grief. As adults, we have a hard time dealing with the emotions that go with grief, and children have the same emotions that we do. And unfortunately, a lot of times they kind of get, you know, a little pushed off, like they're a kid, they're playing, they're good, and they're really struggling to understand what's going on with them. So Adam's House is that place to kind of normalize that you know, emotional, you know, hotbed, and really kind of get the support they need from other children going through exactly what they're going through.
So as you had this nugget of inspiration that was rooted in this personal tragedy and, and family experience, what other expertise or connections or experiences did you bring to the table to help the long journey that eventually ended up with us all standing here in the living room now, a couple of months post ribbon cutting, with Adam's House now essentially open for business as a fully functioning human service entity?
You know, I was really fortunate early in the process to stumble across an organization that I thought was really important to bring to Adam's House, and that's Olivia's House in Pennsylvania. And I met with her, and, you know, she first day she said, you know, I'll help you do this. I'll mentor you through the process. And they've been doing it and been doing amazing things in York, Pennsylvania for about 20 years. And they are true to their word. They've kind of helped us every step of the way. They've flown in, their staff has flown in and done our first round of FIG training. And really our program and our curriculum shadows theirs. And, you know, they do good work, and we're hoping to do just the same thing here for the kids in Connecticut.
So do you and your team learn about families who sadly were in a shared kind of tragic situation that you found yourself in a few years ago and perform sort of the outreach and recruitment, if you will, for Adam's House? Or do potential clients who would come to stay here and families who would come to stay here learn about you as among a raft of support services that might be availed to them by other intervening law enforcement or social or human service agencies?
Right. I mean, it really could come from anywhere. I mean, our program is an 8-week program. It runs it's like a dinner time thing. So it's from 6 to 8:30. And families would find out about us from therapists that they might be seeing for counseling, schools, funeral homes, hospitals, and and pretty like why you're here, mm-hmm. you know, the community itself. Yeah, and, you know, and I do just want to mention that, you know, Adams House is running this program at no cost. And we have, as part of the program, our families do get referred to one of our partner therapists for 4 visits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while the insurance might cover that, even if it doesn't, Adams House will cover half of that and the partner therapist will cover half. So really anyone who needs support can find support here.
And let me just clarify this. So they don't have to engage in the sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, that sort of captive wrapping in-house program. You can sort of provide some measure of support to families who, for whatever reason, either can't or don't have the facility to actually stay here for that concentrated program period?
Right. Well, they don't sleep here, so they come and they do have to commit for the 8 weeks.
Okay.
It's theme-based, so we have a curriculum every single one of those weeks, and we do really mandate that they come for the 8 weeks. So we understand kids get sick. You know, we have some good technology, so if they can't make 1 week, we might try to Skype them in.
Yeah.
If the family misses 2, then we kind of ask them to step out of that session and join the next one, because it's really important during that 8 weeks, your families are starting together and they're graduating together,
right.
And you're building that sense of community. So you don't want families, you know, disappearing for 2 weeks and then coming back.
Right.
And so to keep the continuity of the group and that support, we ask them to commit to the 8 weeks. And they do get some notice, so they have to carve that out. And this has to be priority above all else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And either based on what you have seen practically or hands-on right here in Shelton, or what you've seen as you're learning from your partners in York, Pennsylvania, talk a little bit about how they're achieving success by creating that sort of captive and wrapping atmosphere.
You know, look, there's comfort and there's power in numbers. And so nothing speaks to you. I mean, look, we have support for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And as adults, we go, look, we have Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's helpful because you're in a room with people experiencing the same thing. We have it for weight loss. We have it for a whole host of reasons.
Sure.
Why not give kids the same opportunity to be in that group and gain support and comfort from children going through the same thing they are?
Excellent. Allison Wysota, founder of Adams House. If you'd like to learn more, it's adamshouse.ct.org, or you can always call 203-513-2808, especially if you would care to support the organization. As you're hearing, they have many services that do end up creating some cost issues for participants if they want to, say, continue therapy sessions or what have you. You can give them a call also to learn about volunteer opportunities. We're going to be talking to Mark Fontaine, who's one of those newly recruited volunteers, in just a few minutes. But we'll take an opportunity now to begin a conversation before our break with Laura Schlossberg, who's the program coordinator here at Adams House. We spoke to her in our earlier program. Laura, great to see you again, and thanks for joining us. I wanted to, before we take a break and talk specifically about the programming, to clarify in your literature and on your website, you describe Adams House as a closed-ended educational model. Can you clarify what that is all about?
Yes. So the difference between a closed group and an open group, in an open group, members can join at any time. So it's an ongoing program. They can step in at any moment. In a closed group, the group has a beginning and an end time, and everybody that starts in the group finishes together in the group. We don't have members joining at any point during that. The concept behind a closed group is that you establish a rapport and a sense of community and with the same group of people, and they find a cohesion together. When you have an open group, there's a lot of coming and going.
Mm.
And so we think that the closed group model supports our mission.
Excellent. For people who are coming to the organization, we didn't get into the specifics of the age groups that can be served. Can you just expound on a little bit of that, and then we'll dig into some of the age-specific programming?
Mm-hmm. So we have essentially 3 groups. We have a littles group, a middles group, and a teen group. Essentially, the littles group is 4 to 7. The middles group is about 8 to 12. The teen group is 13 through 18. There's some give and take in that. For kids who are on the cusp of those ages, we would just place them as we see it appropriate. So that is essentially the age range, 4 through 18.
Right. Once again, AdamsHouseCT.org is the website if you'd like to learn more, or call Adams House to make an appointment if you find that you know someone or your family was in a situation much like Allison's, facing the death of a family member. They would love to hear from you. Their phone number is 203-513-2808. We're going to take a quick break, come back and talk about some of the specifics and challenges of the various age ranges and programs that happen here at Adams House, and hear from Mark Fontaine, who's a recently recruited volunteer, and come back to wrap up with Adams House founder Allison Wysota. Stick with us.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. And you can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Sarah Speaks Up, a nonprofit promoting domestic violence awareness, is holding a Voices for Victims fundraiser on October 22nd from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Library Wine Bar and Bistro in Wallingford. Tickets are $75 and include fruit and cheese, hors d'oeuvres, a pasta dish, beer and wine, live music, inspirational speakers, and a silent auction. Veterans for Victims is a first-of-its-kind initiative that pairs veterans who are domestic violence victims with a trained escort to help them from court and in through court proceedings, providing them with a feeling of safety, security, and support. Find out all about it and link to their online ticket service by visiting Sarah, with an H, SarahSpeaksUp.org.
Well, thanks for hanging around. We're here in Shelton at Adams House, supported by the Adam Wysota Foundation and established in 2012 to honor the legacy of Mr. Wysota, the beloved husband, father, Little League coach, and active volunteer from Weston, Connecticut, late husband of Adams House founder Allison Wysota, working to find a healing place for families suffering through the death of a immediate loved one. Since so many children often feel alone in their grief, Adams House was established as a special place for these families to come together so that no child grieves alone. We're talking with Laura Schlossberg. She's program coordinator, and she provided us before the break with just kind of a breakdown of the age range separations that they deal with here in terms of programming. So, Laura, let's start with the parents and the role that they play, because sometimes, you know, not to diminish the grief of the loss of a loved one, but much like when you're sort of, you know, teaching a kid to ride a bike or drive a car or the alphabet, sometimes it's better left to an instructor or a outside person that's a little bit more at arm's length than someone who's directly connected moment to moment, like a parent would be, and especially, I guess, in situations where you may lose another parent or loved one, sometimes maybe creating some space in that proximity kind of serves the whole process.
That's right. One thing to remember is that the parents are grieving as well, and that they need to not only support the children in their grief, but they also need support. So Adams House provides that. We also have a parent group while the children are meeting. We also have the parents and caregivers on site so that they as well are getting peer support and education, not only to address their own grief and loss, but to empower them and educate them on how to manage the grief of their children. So the groups, as they run, each group is separated by age. The parents are down in our family room meeting with facilitators, our FIGs, we call them our friends in grief.
Yeah.
And the littles, mills, and teen groups are upstairs. And every week that they come here for the 2 hours, they all, even though they're in different age groups, they are all working on the same theme that week.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to the parents getting support to support themselves and their children, the siblings are getting the same type of education. They're working on the same activities as it's age appropriate. And then we find that our hope is that that will bring a greater sense of cohesion for the siblings. They can go home, they can in the car ride home, talk about what they did. And they all are basically doing the same theme. So if that week's theme was talking about feelings and expressing and identifying feelings, they've all done an activity as it relates to that theme, but again, in an age appropriate way.
So let's pick up on that to illustrate how you come at delivering this type of programming in the age range sectors that you have here, the 3 to 6, 7 to 12, and 13 to 18. Take an activity under the umbrella that you were just describing and tell us a little bit about how you might roll that activity out to a child in the 3 to 6 range versus, say, in the teen range of 13 to 18.
Mm-hmm. So we have something. It's an icebreaker we would do at the first week to help the group get comfortable with one another. It's words and pics. So perhaps with the younger group, it would be, depending on their literacy range, it might just be all pictures. With the older kids, they could focus on the pictures and the words. They're all laminated words, pictures from magazines displayed on a table. We ask them to just pick a few pictures and words that resonate with you. And the little children can do that, the teens can do that, the middles can do that. And then we ask the children if they want to share what drew them to those words and pictures. It might be an art activity that is something that all the ages can do. It just depends on how we're going to manipulate the activity to make it appropriate for each age.
And how do you deal with the unique challenges that might present in your teen client base, where they're not only dealing with the same incident that has caused the grief, but they're also at the same time going through the whole teen emotional roiling that happens, when young people are at that age.
Right. So one of the things that we promote in our training of our FIGS, our Friends in Grief, is that nobody's forced to share. It's their own comfort level, especially with teens and middle schoolers. Anybody can take a pass on any one of the activities. They could sit and observe, and that might be the way they get what they need out of the group. So the level of participation is completely voluntary, and nobody's forced to share if they're uncomfortable. I think that when other teens and middles are willing to share, the teens who might be quiet, they're gaining something as well. They might be identifying with something that's being expressed by another group member.
So they're all free to have the flexibility to kind of find their place in the space you give them. That's great. Laura Schlossberg is program coordinator for Adams House in Shelton. AdamsHouseCT.org is their website. If you'd like to learn more, consider supporting the organization with a donation or volunteer time. You can call 203-513-2808. One of the people that called that number or was made to call that number was Mark Fontaine, and he's here with us today. He's a recently recruited volunteer for Adams House. Mark, what brought you to this organization of all of the nonprofits and activities that you might have been able to put your energy to?
Well, John, thank you very much for having us, and I'm delighted to speak about my already high level of enthusiasm at being an early volunteer here at Adams House. It certainly wasn't so much arm-twisting, but Adams House and its mission strongly appeals to me and my own lifelong objective and ambition to work for a nonprofit with a very strong and valued mission statement. I just concluded a long career in financial services. I worked for a large global bank. And one of the most compelling features of what I used to do in financial services was the ability to work with the corporate giving programs of these institutions and really working within the community, and not just writing checks, but being in the community to help rebuild, to help at-risk youth. And that was always one of the most rewarding aspects of my career.
And great orientation for stepping right into this realm.
Exactly. And at the same time, as I left Wall Street, it was growing, it was increasingly evident that people joining Wall Street wanted to work for a firm that also had a strong sense of being within the community and working with these corporate giving programs. And in fact, I was responsible for morale for a rather large group within the bank I worked for. And aside from monetary concerns, what was most important for the staff, new and existing staff, was to work for an organization where they would have flex time, where they could work within the community with the bank as a sponsorship.
In the couple minutes that we have left with you, what are a couple of the things that you want to dig right into, needs that you see that your expertise can fulfill?
The needs I see, and what was in great evidence when we went recruiting recently at Sacred Heart University, again, was a strong desire, especially amongst the millennials, to participate, to volunteer. Mm-hmm. They're very focused academically, obviously, and professionally where they want to be, but at the same time to achieve a very significant and ethic-based work-life balance where they can give back and work within the community. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to focus, as I grow within Adam's House here, to work also on that part of our marketing strategy to embrace all these volunteers that want to work here. And the turnout at Sacred Heart was very, very strong for our organization.
Yeah, I also think that, to engage millennials, you really need to give them an opportunity to both immediately feel like they're making a difference, almost not from the first day, but the first 10 minutes they walk through the door. But they can see it as something that they can learn from and take with them for the rest of their lives, kind of like you did in your career.
Exactly.
Excellent. In the last couple of minutes we have, we go back to Allison Wysota, who started this whole thing a few years back as an idea to help families, and it's grown now, celebrated their ribbon cutting, had their grand opening. They now have programming in process. So I guess the last thing to talk to you about, Allison, is bringing and sustaining the support you need to keep Adam's House growing to the point where perhaps it's going to begin to serve as a model, just like your mentors and partners in New York, Pennsylvania served Adam's House as being a model.
Right. So, what you said, we need the money to keep the doors open. Mm-hmm. So, there's always the piece, and probably unfortunately my least favorite piece is the fundraising. Yeah. The grants also. So we have a grant writer. We were really fortunate to receive some nice grant money from CT Love and Connoisseur Media, and that was for our miniature room, which was great, and that work is being completed as we speak. We also received a great grant from Weekly Memorial Funeral Home. They sponsored us for Matthews Children's Foundation grant, and so all those little nuggets definitely help us. And now we're kind of getting ready for our paddle fundraiser, and we have some sponsorships available, so that will be hopefully very successful, because that will help us kind of put money in the bank and keep our programs at no cost to the families.
Fantastic. A healing place here in Shelton, Connecticut, providing grief educational programs to families looking for empathy, guidance, and support after losing a loved one in the immediate family. If you'd like to learn more, volunteer, support the organization, or perhaps you know somebody who could benefit from the programming, check them out at adamshousect.org, or call Adam's House to create a volunteer opportunity for yourself at 203-513-2808, or again, Adam's House. CT.org. Folks, thanks for having us down here in Shelton today. Well, we're going to wrap up the program this morning with a little bit of culture with an important social message. Can you imagine not knowing your own identity? Well, that's the reality for millions of adoptees. And the focus of Suzanne Bochner's award-winning show, The Good Adoptee, which is coming to Connecticut to help garner support for restoring Connecticut adoptees' access to their original birth certificates. As I was talking with Suzanne before we turned on the microphone, I was able to articulate that I was adopted myself. So this is something that resonated with me. But we also want to be completely transparent here. Not the only reason why we brought her on to the line. So without further ado, let me introduce playwright Suzanne Bochner. Suzanne, thanks for calling in with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as we said, the run of this show, which is going to be traveling all around the state, starts next Saturday, October 22nd, as we broadcast this program. And its first performance is going to be at the United Methodist Church in Hamden. Then it's moving to the United Methodist Church in Watertown, the First Congregational Church of Ridgefield, the Charter Oak Cultural Center in Hartford, then off to the First Church of Christ in New Haven, Yukon, Stamford, the Holy Trinity Church in Enfield, back to Mansfield, to Questor's Way, and will wrap up on December 9th at King Street United Church of Christ in Danbury. So there's no reason or excuse for anyone to not get out and see this important show. So tell us a little bit about The Good Adoptee and what led you to write it.
Well, The Good Adoptee is my totally true story of searching for my identity and origins in the face of New York City's sealed records, or New York State sealed records. And I really felt, after I went through this whole experience of being a sort of a good adoptee who said, oh, I don't want to open Pandora's box, I don't want to look into that, and then finding as an adult that I really had so much missing information that I needed. And then when I finally got the courage to look, I found out I was not permitted by the state to find this information. And I had a real quest. And quests like that just are great dramatic fodder, because it just lent itself to being put on stage as a story, as a theatrical story.
Yeah, I imagine the first dramatic moment in your life was that moment that you learned you were adopted. And since I'm talking, to someone else who's familiar with it, for me, I don't remember a time. I'm going to be 55 in a couple of weeks, and I don't remember ever not knowing I was adopted. My parents, for whatever reason, were very forthright with me. I actually remember them when I was very, very young, being in the presence of other people who were talking about it, and actually with me in the room, having them sort of try shushing my mother, saying, well, John is right here. You want him to hear that? And she said, oh, he's known for a long time that he was adopted. When was that dramatic moment that you first had knowledge of or realization that you were adopted?
John, I had such a similar kind of experience, because I don't remember being told. It's like I always knew. As you have that kind of experience, and my parents were very, very thrilled to have me in the family, and so excited to have a child. And the adoption piece was always just part of the fabric of our family narrative. It was never shrouded in secrecy or shame. And I always say that it was like I was conceived when my parents brought me home because of that narrative, instead of that I have this whole, kind of first chapter that I was unaware of.
Mm.
So it's like my life began at adoption instead of conception.
So certainly, I would imagine, like with myself, when people hear about this show and the issue is so personal to them, you've got kind of a built-in audience. They're going to want to come out and see it maybe multiple times at multiple stops over the course of the couple of months that it'll be here in Connecticut. But for folks who have no no roots or basis in adoption or no adoption related experience, what do you hope to impart on those audience members when they come to see the show?
Well, we've been thrilled as we've been presenting the show in various places, how many non-adoptees and people who are outside the adoption community and that personal experience themselves have connected to the themes of the play, because they're very universal themes that are very dramatic for an adoptee, but feelings of the theme of belonging and identity and the search for identity, these are things that every human being goes through in life. We have a very specific and very varied among many different adoptee experiences journey of that, but people have really had those themes resonate with them and have been very deeply moved. And what I've been thrilled about is just that they've connected their own non-adoptee experiences to my specific adoptee experience in that way. And that's been amazing, because sometimes it's like, oh, you're adopted. It's what you're talking about, your parents' friends with the, you know, the secrecy and shame around it. Mm. It's like that experience is the other, the adoptee is the other. And, you know, there's such a continuum of those sorts of themes with human beings. And that's what I'd love to do, to connect to a wider audience in terms of this struggle.
Okay. So why Connecticut? Why now? Why are you bringing the Good Adoptee here to the state over the next couple of months?
Well, this was such a great partnership that began because we wanted to get the story out to other people, and there's such a movement right now across the country for allowing adoptees to reestablish their access, our access to our original birth certificates. And Access Connecticut has been leading amazing lobbying efforts that culminated in 2014 with opening the records for adoptees whose adoptions were finalized after October 1st, 1983. And when you have sort of a portion of the population, you know, even among adoptees who have that right, and then you're looking at, people after this date of before the date of October 1st, 1983, do not have that access. I mean, that just, it's the urgency of fixing that that problem is right there.
Yeah.
And so they're doing, you know, this amazing next round of lobbying efforts. And so it just seemed like the perfect fundraiser and the perfect way to communicate the issues, even though my story is obviously takes place in New York and it's about the sealed records in New York. It's completely applicable, to the Connecticut sealed records.
Yeah.
Well, who can't access their original birth certificate in this country, you know, versus every other American who's not an adoptee, who just, you know, takes it for granted, there's obviously this injustice that's going on that needs to be tackled in every state.
Yeah. Well, for every adopted child whose parents hoped to find them a better way by signing them off for adoption, there are adoptees who were the byproducts or victims of trauma. And aside from Access Connecticut Now, which is the grassroots organization that's restoring, working to restore adult adoptees rights to know their original identity, CALO Programs is another organization that's also helping to bring this this series of presentations of the Good Adoptee to Connecticut. Can you just take a minute to tell us a little bit more about CALO Programs?
CALO is an extraordinary organization, and they have sponsored the tour with Access Now. So it's just been such a terrific, partnership with these organizations, and bringing the story through an arts experience to an audience who can experience that and also become active. And, you know, you're talking about people who are not adoptees getting involved, and it's like we need all the allies that we can get, you know, in this fight, because if adoptees, you know, don't have this basic essential information and this basic fundamental civil right, we all should be concerned about this.
Excellent. Well, if folks are listening and they want to find out a little bit more before making plans to go out and see the Good Adoptee, they can go to thegoodadoptee.com or to the websites of the sponsoring agencies, accessconnecticut.org and caloprograms.com, which, as we mentioned, is a family of programs specialized in addressing the dysfunctional patterns that come up due to early trauma trauma, particularly in families with adopted children. They have a number of programs that are worthy of checking out at kaloprograms.com, C-A-L-O programs.com. And before we say farewell to the good adoptee herself and the playwright of this spectacular show that's going to be touring Connecticut, Suzanne Bochner, we want to once again remind you that you can see it. Tickets are $25, $20 for seniors, students, and veterans. And you can begin to see the run of The Good Adoptee on October 22nd at United Methodist Church in Hamden, November 4th at United Methodist Church in Watertown, November 11th at First Congregational Church in Ridgefield, the 12th at Charter Oak Cultural Center in Hartford, November 18th at the First Church of Christ in New Haven, November 19th at UConn Stamford, December 2nd at Holy Trinity Episcopal in Enfield, December 3rd at Questers Way in Mansfield, and it wraps its Connecticut run on Friday, December 9th at the King Street United Church of Christ in Danbury. We want to thank our guest, playwright Suzanne Bochner, for being with us and giving us her own story and inspiration behind The Good Adoptee. Suzanne, I wish you great luck from one to another, and I can't wait to see the show. So thanks for helping us close out the program this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voket@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voket, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.